Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 127, The Authoritarian Personality, December 19th, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
When I talk about authoritarianism, I'm talking about, on the leader's part, a strong need to dominate, a personality-based need to control, to exert power, to have power. And on the follower's part, I'm talking about a strong need to submit to powerful authorities who will sort of take over their lives and tell them what to do. It is a personality-based thing.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Robert Altemeyer. Robert Altemeyer, Ph.D., is Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Manitoba and is the world's leading authority on the authoritarian personality, a topic he has researched and written on extensively. In fact, he's made a book on this topic available for free, and there'll be a link to that in our show notes. Dr. Altemeyer describes himself as follows, and I quote, "Who am I? I'm a nearly retired psychology professor in Canada who has spent most of his life studying authoritarianism. I got into this field by being lazy. When I took the exams for getting a PhD at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh in 1965, I failed a question about a famous early effort to understand the authoritarian personality. I had to write a paper to prove I could learn at least something about this research, which had gotten itself into a huge hairy mess by then. However, I got caught up in the tangle too. Thus, I didn't start studying authoritarianism because I'm a left-winger, I think I'm a moderate on most issues, or because I secretly hated my father. I got into it because it presented a long series of puzzles to be solved, and I love a good mystery." Close quote. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Robert Altemeyer, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You're the planet's leading authority on the authoritarian personality. No pun intended.
And it's no great honor to be the leading authority on authoritarianism, let me tell you.
Right, I can understand. I seem to recall some research on the authoritarian personality way back when I was in graduate school.
Yeah,
it's been around for a while. Why don't you start off by defining the term for us and giving us a bit of its history in the field of psychology?
Well, authoritarianism, by my definition, is something that leaders and followers cook up between themselves. Basically, the leaders demand submission and the followers submit. And then I can get more elaborate than that. We probably will. As for the history of the concept, it really goes back, if you want firm footing, it goes back to a research project that began across the bay from you. You're in Sonoma?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, well, over at Berkeley, back in the 1940s, a psychologist named Nevitt Sanford began to do research on antisemitism and other prejudices that eventually produced the volume called The Authoritarian Personality.
Okay, and I recognize his name, so that's probably what I'm remembering from graduate school. Go ahead.
Most people remember the book as Adorno et al., because Theodore Adorno was the first named author. But the real leader of the project was Sanford. Adorno was sort of forced on the other authors by the people who had the money, who were sponsoring the research. And there was a squabble over naming rights when the book was about to be published. So Sanford very graciously said, let's do it alphabetically. And Theodore Adorno became associated in so many people's minds with this book on the authoritarian personality. He actually had very little to do with it. He's the least involved in the authors. Wasn't even at Berkeley. He was down in Los Angeles and so on.
Oh, my goodness. Now, but the you know, you said it's all about leaders who want to have followers and the followers follow. But really, there's the implication that there's some kind of a underlying personality structure that's prone to be a follower.
Yes, yes. When I talk about authoritarianism, I'm talking about, on the leader's part, a strong need to dominate, a personality-based need to control, to exert power, to have power. And on the follower's part, I'm talking about a strong need to submit to powerful authorities who will sort of take over their lives and tell them what to do. It is a personality-based thing.
Okay. Now, I'm under the impression that early on there was some critique of the concept. What is that critique, and have you managed to lay it to rest?
Oh, well, the original Authoritarian Personality, the book that was published in 1950, was critiqued to death. There was another book, a whole book that came out critiquing it 4 years later, edited by Dick Christie and Maureen Yehuda, and they just found, the people who contributed to that book, just found enormous problems with the research methodology and with the thinking and with the conceptualization and with the theory and the underlying Freudian model that guided them and so on. That didn't stop research from going ahead, but the research was very badly flawed. And so after about 20 years, by the early 1970s or so, it was pretty clear that this field was not only dormant, but it hadn't really accomplished anything. There had been probably over 1,000 studies published on the authoritarian personality by then using the Berkeley tool called the F scale. And there was just enormous confusion in the literature as to what anything was, what was found, what anything meant, and so on.
And yet there must have been some underlying conviction that there was something here worth looking at to drive this much research. So how did you get into studying the authoritarian personality?
Am I being lazy? I tell the story in the book that you and I are talking about, that when I was taking my PhD candidacy exams in 1965, I was asked a question about the authoritarian personality, all this research, and I didn't know anything about it. So I failed that question on my candidacy exam and went on to pass the rest of the questions. So they gave me a pass provided I could write a paper on this. So I did, and I got sort of really hooked on the big mess that this field was in. And so it had nothing to do with my hating my father or with my being a communist or anything like that. It was just, it's a real fulfillment of an Alfred Adler personality, where you find out what your perceived weaknesses and you spend the rest of your life overcompensating for it.
Oh, my goodness. And I should mention that the book that you just made reference to is a book that is on your website, and it's free to people, and it's extremely readable, and I'll put a link to it on my website. What's the title?
It's called The Authoritarians.
Oh, yeah. I don't know why I had trouble remembering that. I've just been reading it and I'm very impressed by it. So, I will put a link to that. So, please give us an overview of your research.
Well, we know a lot more about authoritarian followers than we do about the leaders. We've only developed, some other people developed a scale that turned out to be a very good way to measure this power-hungriness that we find in authoritarian leaders. excuse me. I'm fighting a cold here.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear it.
Yeah, well, anyway, so the Berkeley research and then the research that other people have done since then, including my own, has given us a lot of knowledge and insight about the followers. And so we know tons about them. And a good conceptualization of this personality trait is that these people are very submissive to established authority. They're very aggressive in the name of that authority. There's a lot of hostility in them, which has some interesting psychological roots. And they're very conventional. They really insist that everybody follow the rules and the norms of behavior that their authorities preach. So we have a scale for measuring that. It's a 20-item scale now. that measures being an authoritarian personality follower. And it's been used lots and lots of research in lots of places now around the world. And basically, a literature has emerged which is much cleaner, much more consistent, and digs deeper, I think, into the authoritarian follower than anything we've had before.
Mm-hmm. What are some typical items on that scale?
Well, I'll give you the first one, for example. You can yell up and down if this really turns you on, but I don't think you will. Our country desperately needs a mighty leader who will do what has to be done to destroy the radical new ways and sinfulness that are ruining us. And people respond to that on a -4 to +4 basis. And if you look at that statement and a lot of the other statements on the scale, you can see that it's tapping these three underlying elements. Submission, we need a mighty leader. The aggression, we need a leader who will destroy, and destroy what? The radical new ways and sinfulness. That's the conventionalism. So the scale has equal number of pro-trait and contrait items, so it controls for response sets, which is something, a big problem the F scale from the Berkeley research did not do. And it has very high internal consistency. It's very common for these 20 items to pull down an alpha of about 0.90. And so it's psychometrically a pretty internally consistent, reliable, and rather powerful scale. And it comes up with relatively powerful findings compared to what we find generally in the journals nowadays as we look at things.
Okay, now you've mentioned submissiveness, aggressiveness, and social conventionality. Does the scale relate to other important personality variables? For example, things like intelligence or rigidity versus flexibility or psychopathology, permeability of boundaries, the Myers-Briggs?
No, yes, no, no, yes, and don't know. Now, which one do you want to talk about? As for intelligence, there is a correlation of about 0.20 in general populations, somewhere in the 0.20s, between scores on this follower scale and being a negative correlation between scores on this and the amount of education the person has had. Education, we know from longitudinal studies, lowers your tendency to be an authoritarian follower, and people who aren't as well educated score higher in that trait of being the follower. Don't know anything about the Myers-Briggs. Rigidity, yeah, we can certainly point to experiments on dogmatism in which people insist that black is white despite the evidence staring them right in the face. So, yeah, high RWAs, high authoritarian followers are very, tend to be quite rigid and so on.
So there's not really a strong hardly any correlation at all between intelligence and being an authoritarian follower. And in fact, I think you remark, I mean, both of us have been in an academic environment. We've both had colleagues, haven't we, who were strongly
authoritarian. I've especially had authoritarian leaders in my experience.
Yeah, like university presidents.
You can find authoritarian followers and leaders almost anywhere. I don't think authoritarian followers are stupid people by any means. I think they're scared. I think they are a lot of other things. But I don't think that they are what they are because of a lack of intelligence. And I don't think they're psychologically ill or sick or anything like that.
Okay. And we were talking about how early on there was this critique of the concept. Has, the tighter methodologies that you and others have employed in more recent years, has that pretty much laid the critique to rest? Or are there people out there who make their full-time research job undermining your research?
One of the really interesting things about this has been that there certainly has been criticism of it. That's the whole idea involved in the scientific method.
Sure.
The critiques have mainly dealt with what is what do the data really mean? What does the scale really measure? What is authoritarianism most based on? And so you can find other authors who say that what you're really measuring here is a strong need for group identification rather than what Bob Altemeyer says. So, yeah, there certainly has been that. I don't think there's any convincing evidence that that's the case, but people have suggested that. But as far as the findings themselves, they are so widely replicated and they are so strong that really there hasn't been any kind of dagger to the heart saying this whole stuff is completely wrong, there's a technical malfunction or a methodological problem or so forth. I think that there's a pretty good consensus among people involved in this area, with, of course, some people who wouldn't agree, is that the findings are stable and predictable and powerful.
Okay, well, let's see if we can understand what's going on. In one of your chapters, you review a Freudian theory to account for the authoritarian personality. Then you go on to talk about Bandura's social learning theory, and then I think kind of your own general synthesis theory. Take us through those, if you will.
Well, the original Berkeley theory, this is Berkeley versus Stanford, by the way.
Uh-huh.
A familiar concept where you live. But the original Berkeley theory was strongly influenced by Freudian thought. It thought that the authoritarian personality was rooted in early childhood experiences. I think everybody knows the story. The authoritarian adult as a kid had really mean, distant, cold, harsh parents, and the kid hated them, but when he showed displeasure, he got whacked around, and repressed all of that hatred and formed a reaction formation and replaced it with adoring love, and then he projected his hostility toward his parents onto other targets that were safe to attack and displaced his hostility and became very prejudiced. That's it in a nutshell. There are problems with that that were pointed out very quickly by lots of people. The biggest problem scientifically is that it's so untestable because it's all repressed and you can't find evidence of this. And if you look for things like, do people who have strong inclinations to be authoritarian followers come from brutal backgrounds or they were whacked around a lot or had harsh parents or so on, there really is almost no research that shows that. As I tried to figure out what was causing people to be what they are, I looked at a number of different theoretical perspectives, and the one of Albert Bandura at Stanford, his social learning theory, seemed to me to do the best job and offer the best explanation of things, which in contrast to the Freudian theory says that sure, childhood experiences are important, but they're not the end of the story, that later experiences in life and the role that models play in our learning and behavior and understanding of things and so on are what determined it. This model is so good that I've got an experiences scale which asks people to describe in various ways the experiences they've had in their lives with the authorities they've known, and what have their experiences been with being unconventional and with the targets that people often attack and so on. And if I know an intro psych student's score on the experiences scale, I can make a pretty good prediction of how big an authoritarian follower she or he is going to be. The correlation between the two scales is 0.7 something in study after study. So these later experiences influence us quite a bit. So there's a difference between the Berkeley model and the social learning model that I think works best. I can give you more if you want to talk about why authoritarians are aggressive.
Yeah, sure. I'd love to hear about that. And you made reference to research with undergraduates, and we actually haven't said much about the research that you've done, probably because you've done so much of it. But you've researched lots and lots of students at your university, at other universities, and the parents of students, and you've done longitudinal studies. And So I just
and I've even studied American state legislators at almost all of the state legislatures in the 50 states there are. So,
wow.
Yeah, lots of different groups have been involved. We studied people in the Soviet Union, and lots of other people have been doing this, too, now. I don't want to say it's a hot field. I hope it never becomes a hot field. There has been a lot of research on a lot of different places, yeah.
Okay. Well, you were gonna
talk about aggression.
Wax rhapsodically about aggression, yes.
Yeah, well, I hope I don't. That reminds me of the shooting in Colorado and the reaction to that, by the way. Maybe we'll get on to that. But the Berkeley theory of the origin of aggression was, as I just said, it was caused by displaced hatred of the authorities. That the kid learned that was the only safe way to act was to adore them, but deep down he hated them and needed to find somebody to take it out on. The social learning model of aggression that Bandura advances says that aggressive behavior is the result of an instigation, something that makes us want to aggress, and then some sort of a releaser, something that lets us aggress when we feel like doing it, because there are all sorts of inhibitions against being aggressive. And a series of experiments that I ran over a number of years found that basically you could explain most of the variance in a number of different measures of prejudice and hostility and aggressiveness if you had a measure of how scared people were, how fearful they were of the world, how much they saw the world as a dangerous place, and how self-righteous they were, how much they felt like they were the very best people that there could possibly be. And if you had those two scores, which match up pretty well with Bandura's idea of an instigator fear and a releaser self-righteousness, you could explain most of the variance. And that this was a series of pitting experiments in which you give other theories a chance to try to predict things as well, and nothing could come close to what those two factors could do. So it seems like the hostility you find so often in authoritarian followers is based upon, more than anything else, they're just being very frightened and feeling that they're the good guys, they're God's designated hitters, and so they can go and attack whom they want because it's all in a good cause.
This is I'm having some sort of state versus trait thoughts here, that in general we're talking about traits and personality variables, but I'm also aware that sometimes, you know, I don't think of myself as an authoritarian generally, but I do know that I have a sort of inner Richard Nixon, and there are times when my fear level gets stimulated or my self-righteousness can get stimulated. So,
to be sure.
Yeah.
One of the series of experiments I did asked people to role play what their scores, what their attitudes would be on this measure of being an authoritarian follower under various scenarios in the future. And I said, you know, imagine that this is the case and this is happening in the country and blah, blah, blah. And if there is if there's trouble in the future, if social stability seems threatened, and in general people become more likely to look to the authorities to solve problems. And what was interesting about that was that if the trouble was caused by, let's call them leftists, there were mass strikes, there were rioting in the street by left-wing demonstrators and so forth, then that made people become much more authoritarian. But the other thing that we found was that if the troublemakers in the street were right-wingers who were trying to establish a coup d'etat, or else there were right-wingers in the street throwing bricks, some sort of a fascist movement, that also made people become more authoritarian. That your inner Richard Nixon responds to fear. Another good example of it is in Canada, when a couple of years ago there was a referendum in Quebec, in which the people of Quebec had the opportunity to say whether they wanted to separate from the rest of the country. And the rest of the country was pretty worried that a majority of the Quebecois would say they did. And as it turned out, it was a razor-thin decision to stay in Canada. But at that time, I found in my studies here is that people where I live in the middle of the country in the province of Manitoba, quite a distance from Quebec, became significantly more hostile toward Quebecers, the Quebecois, when the fate of the country was sort of in their hands. And then that went down after the referendum was over. But when there is some kind of immense fear going on, then it's quite normal for people to react that way, I think.
Well, of course, I'm also now thinking of 9/11, and
sure,
you know, and sure. I think there was a big upsurge of fear and self-righteousness, and perhaps our national character swung a bit to the authoritarian.
And, of course, there was at the same time a strong endorsement of the leadership. So that was when George W. Bush had his very highest ratings of the job he was doing. It turns out he wasn't really doing, I don't think, that different a job or that good a job. But at that time, there was this sort of huge, we've got to get behind the president and support the president and do what he says because he is our leader.
Yes.
And it wasn't just authoritarians saying that. It was 80% of the population thought he was doing a good job.
Exactly. And I think fear played a big role in that, as your research seems to suggest. You had some kind of passing thought about recent shootings in Colorado?
Well, this is really interesting. There was, I guess it's just one gunman who shot some people at a missionary school and then went down to this mega church in Colorado Springs and shot some people, and then he was killed there by a security guard. This is sort of breaking news, so I may be greatly misinformed. The thing that caught my eye about this was the statement that Tony Perkins released yesterday. He's the head of the Family Research Council, and he sent out an email to all of his followers. And he blamed the assault on the secular media, which has been, he said, making people hate evangelicals. And that really caught my eye, because if you notice, first I have to say that evangelicals in the United States and in Canada tend very strongly to be authoritarian followers. You have trouble finding any other group that scores as high on the authoritarian follower scale as these people do. And so these are the people that Tony Perkins is talking to. If you listen to them and you follow them, you notice how often they say, if you don't agree with them, that you must hate God, or you must hate America, or you must hate the president to say that, or you must hate our troops if you don't support the war, or you must hate evangelicals. It's how often they use the word hate. And so there was Tony Perkins showing them that it's the secular media that are making people hate evangelicals. And I think that's, I mean, I study evangelicals and authoritarians, and I think they're dangerous people, and I'm trying hard to understand them. I don't think I hate them. I don't know anybody who hates evangelicals, but I know lots of evangelicals who hate lots of other people, but they score very high on prejudice scales and so on. So I think this is a good case of projection. I think they are haters much more than they are hated. Okay. The other thing about that statement that caught my eye, of course, was that Tony Perkins blames this on the secular press, on the secular media. Well, secular means that it ain't religious. Secular means that it's concerned with this world, not the next one, or spirituality. And I think what he's showing there is that he doesn't like that kind of media. He wants a religious media. If he just would say this is the media doing this, then it wouldn't have caught my eye at all. But there is this thing to sort of link the word secular with the press in a way that makes you wonder, well, shouldn't the press be secular? Should we have a religious NBC and so forth?
Yeah, you know, as you talk about evangelicals, it stimulates a question that I had before I started reading the book, and then I discovered that you actually address this in the book, talking about fundamentalism. And, you know, I wonder about the wave of fundamentalism that seems to be sweeping the planet, not just in this country, but all over the world. There are various flavors of fundamentalism. Does your research suggest any possible solutions to this dilemma of how we might influence or negotiate with people who are locked into black and white thinking extremes?
No. no, well, that's there are some bad things you can do. Go ahead.
I say that's too bad if it's no.
No, there are some things you can do, and I do mention them at the end of the book. And if people read them and they say, is that all you got? Gee, I was hoping for the solution to all of humanity's problems. So no, I don't think I have the solution to that problem. There are things you can do, given what we understand about fundamentalists and about authoritarian followers, that can lessen the problems they can cause for a democratic society. And those are mentioned in the book, and I just mentioned a few here right now. Certainly education helps, as I said earlier, in the long run, it lowers authoritarianism. Authoritarian followers are very conformist. If they find out that their opinions are at considerable variance to what most people think, they actually shift their opinions so that they're more like everybody else. You can let them get to know you better because they are so ethnocentric, they travel so much in their own in circles and exclude outsiders that they have a very distorted perception of what most people are like. And if you can join them in common cause, such as a lot of fundamentalists today are worried about the environment, and good, so you can work with them cleaning up a street or a stream, or if your church can do joint services with their church and just have some time together, letting them get to know you will probably help in some ways. But the basic thing you have to do right now is outvote them in the United States, because the religious right is a very powerful force, and there have been all these statements that it's dead and gone away, you don't have to worry about it anymore. And just look at what's happening in the first real show in Iowa, as Governor Huckabee now has come out of nowhere because he has the support of this very well-organized group of people on the religious right. So there are lots of things we can do.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm wondering about if American media might play a possible role. I don't generally think of it playing a possible role, but I wonder if it could play a role in making people less authoritarian, you know, by exposing them to a wider range of experiences, to things like gay lifestyle, experiences of other ethnicities, and so on. What do you think about that?
Well, I think the media has done a very important job, if you want to talk about gay rights. In my research, attitudes toward homosexuals have become amazingly more positive in a very short period of time. And one of the things that has contributed, the major thing that has contributed to that, if you ask people why have your opinions changed, is that they've gotten to know some gay people, and they find out that all the stereotypes are really misleading. Another thing that's very important here is that a lot of people get turned off by the hostility toward homosexuals that comes out of the religious right. So that backfires on the religious right. They're seen as being unreasonable and intemperate and far from loving their fellow human beings. So attitudes toward gays has really improved in the data I collect. And this shows up in American polling data, too, in the national samples. The media have played a big role in this, I think, because of the number of programs on television, sitcoms mainly, which present homosexuality as a thing that is there but is not evil, is not a perversion, and the people are likable and they've got the same problems at work and so forth that everybody else does. So one can only agree and also agree with the religious right, who hates these programs, and they say they hate them, that the media does play a good role in these things. The same thing happened with black people.
Yes, I was thinking that myself.
And the same thing happened with women. I mean, there was a time when only men read the news. And nowadays, that would be the silliest thing you could think of. But it was sort of assumed that people wouldn't pay attention to the news if a woman read it. Well, that's gone away.
Yeah. In one place, you talk about authoritarians actually suffering from flaws in their thinking. And let me just read a quote here. You write, "But research reveals that authoritarian followers drive through life under the influence of impaired thinking a lot more than most people do, exhibiting sloppy reasoning, highly compartmentalized beliefs, double standards, hypocrisy, self-blindness, a profound ethnocentrism, and to top it all off, a ferocious dogmatism that makes it unlikely anyone could ever change their minds with evidence or logic. These seven deadly shortfalls of authoritarian thinking eminently qualify them to follow a would-be dictator."
Yeah, I think that says it well. Whoever wrote that thing he was talking about.
Yeah, I thought it said it well, too. You actually have evidence to back that up, though. I mean, it could sound like just, a strong judgment.
The nice thing about this evidence compared to some of the other findings we have is that it's not just correlational, it's experimental. You do experiments and you see what happens. So, for example, let's talk about defensiveness. I several times have gone into IntroPsych classes and handed out a big survey, and people answer various psychological scales, including what is obviously a self-esteem scale. And then I come back at a later time and I tell the class that I'm there to give them personal feedback about their self-esteem score. And I say the self-esteem scale that they answered was a really good, valid scale, and that there's a lot of evidence that people who score high on it do well in life, and people who score low on it have terrible lives. And so then I hand everybody their a feedback sheet in which there is encoded in a way that I show them how to find out what their score was on the self-esteem scale. And the thing is, I give half the class, chosen at random, really high scores, and the other half of the class really low scores. I don't give anybody the real score. And so they go through my encoding process to find out what their score was on the self-esteem scale, and then I've drawn a thing on the board to show them what the range of scores is and so forth. And so some of them get really good news and some of them get really bad news about themselves. They're only going to be deceived about this for another minute or two, but during that minute, that news is setting in. And so then I tell them that I had intended to bring along some handouts today about evidence that the scale really is as valid as I say it is, and I didn't get them printed off in time, so if people want me to bring in one of these handouts for them for the next class, I'll be glad to. And I asked them to write down on the sheet that I gave them if they wanted the handout or not. And so they write that down whether they want it or not, and they pass it to me. So this is a really simple one-factor experiment, good news or bad news about yourself, except I also know on each sheet, because I've coded it, whether the person was a high authoritarian follower or a low authoritarian follower. So here's the payoff. If high authoritarian followers are told that they really do well on something that's good and important, they wanted the feedback. But if they were told they did poorly on something that was important, most of them did not want the feedback. So they're glad to have good news, but they ran away from bad news. Now, you may think that's quite a human characteristic, and I would say it is. But when you look at what the low RWAs did, and these people usually shine in experiment after experiment, they're really quite extraordinary. The low RWAs wanted the feedback no matter what. If they got good news, they wanted it, three-fourths of them wanted it. If they got bad news, three-fourths of them wanted the feedback, wanted the handout to show what the evidence was. So they don't run away from bad news. They probably wanted to see it and argue with it, but they didn't run away. There's a lot of evidence that authoritarian followers run away.
Okay, when you say low RWA, RWA stands for right-wing authoritarian?
Yes, and I keep using that, and we didn't really nail that down, but that's the name of the scale that measures the authoritarian follower.
Okay. Now, I was particularly interested in some of the longitudinal research that you did. You found that education was a leavening experience, that freshmen who come in high in authoritarianism. They dropped down about, what was it, 7%, 10%, somewhere in that range by the time they leave school?
It's much, if I had to give a generalization from the longitudinal studies I've done at my university, it's that if you look at people when they come in their freshman year in September and then look at them as they're about to graduate, there is overall about a 10% drop in their RWA scale scores on their tendency to be an authoritarian follower. It's a bigger drop in the liberal arts than it is in the professional schools, but basically all the schools show that drop. If you look at who dropped the most in another way, you find out that it's the people who came in as high authoritarians who really profit the most from higher education. They drop about 20% overall over those years. And that's really quite thrilling because it shows that change is possible and does occur in this context, and significant amount of change too. Now, not everybody changes, not everybody drops. Somebody goes up, some people go up, but overall, the effect of higher education at a big state university like mine is seems to be very beneficial.
Now, I was intrigued too. You note that most people hold the theory that as we get older, we tend to become more conservative. And in general, you found that people did not tend to rise with age in authoritarianism, except for those who became parents.
That's right. That's the real kicker.
And I can understand that as a parent. I understand that.
Oh, I think we all do. We all find ourselves saying those things we swore we would never say. But the data are, I've done three longitudinal studies that way, which I call alumni studies. In the first one, I contacted people 12 years after they had entered university. And then the second study, it was 18 years later. And then the third study, it was 27 years later. These are all different groups of people, but they all served in my experiments in about the same time in the 1970s. And generally speaking, there is this drop in authoritarianism that we would attribute to the effect of education on them. And if you're not a parent, the drop is big and appreciable. But if you look at the alumni who have become parents, you see that this beneficial education effect has been, to a certain extent, canceled out, and their scores have rebounded back up somewhat compared to the non-parents in their graduating class. And I think it just comes from being a parent. I mean, when you got a two-year-old who wants to go play in the street, and you say, because I said so, that's why, when that becomes your final argument, when they don't believe anything else you say, then your children make you more authoritarian. I've told my kids that every time, you know, they wanted to do something that I didn't want them to do, that I could be a lot nicer if I didn't have to be their dad.
Okay, well, I can certainly identify with that. Well, there's so much
more.
Look
at our kids, I'm sure.
There's so much more that we could talk about here, and I really do want to encourage people to get your book. After all, it is free, and it should not be devalued for that fact. I wonder if there are any last words that you would want to leave our listeners with.
Get organized, get active. I really do fear for the future. I don't mean to make you afraid of a dangerous world, but I do mean to say that realistically we are not out of the woods yet. The United States is, I think, in a great deal of trouble. And if you sit in the boat and leave your oars out of the water, don't be surprised if you drift toward even greater calamities that have befallen the country in the last 8 years. That's what I would say.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Dr. Robert Altmaier, and thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It was my pleasure, David. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Robert Altmaier. This interview was the result of a listener suggestion. In case you've made a suggestion I haven't acted on yet, and wonder whether I do respond to listener suggestions, I definitely do. And in this case, the listener provided me with a link to an interview someone else did with Dr. Altemeyer, and I took a listen, and it really cemented the idea that he would make a good guest. There's an interesting study in the current issue of Scientific American Mind on the response times of liberals versus conservatives in a perceptual conflict task. Subjects had to press a button when the letter M was quickly flashed on a screen, but not when the letter W was flashed up there. And of course, M and W look very similar, except, you know, one is upside down. And because the letter M appeared about 80% of the time, it became a kind of reflex for people to push the button for M. But liberals were better able to avoid the knee-jerk reaction of automatically pressing the M. So that was a very interesting finding. And in the article, they cite other research that seems to support the ideas that liberals are better able to tolerate ambiguity. Now, I really want to very strongly recommend Dr. Altemeyer's book to you all. Given the times we live in, it's an extremely important book, in my opinion. And it also is an extremely readable book that admirably covers the science and his research findings, but with liberal doses of humor. No pun intended by my use of liberal here, by the way. And amazingly, this book is free. It wouldn't have to be free. It's certainly as good as all the books we pay for. The link will be in the Shrink Wrap Radio show notes, but I also want to spell it out here. So pause your player and grab a pen, because here goes. You'll find it at /home.ccc.umanitoba.ca/tilde/ALTEMEY/. So you can see why you might want to go to the website to get it. It's a little hard to spell out. Tilde, of course, is a punctuation mark. You're not supposed to spell out T-I-L-D-E. I doubt that many authoritarian personalities listen to this show, if any. There are far too many ambiguities in many of the topics here, enough to drive an authoritarian bonkers.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Hey, here's something I bet you didn't know. When you're trying to persuade your friends to give Shrink Wrap Radio a try, and you're wondering if they will really remember the awfully difficult to remember URL, www.shrinkwrapradio.com, you can send them off to a different, more memorable address, which is www.psychologypodcast.com. Psychologypodcast.com. What could be easier to remember, right? How can this be? Well, some time back, I used my discount code of shrink3 at godaddy.com to purchase the domain name psychologypodcast.com and have it pointed at shrinkwrapradio.com. So if anybody types in psychologypodcast.com, they will automatically end up at Shrink Wrap Radio. I've just realized I need to get more active promoting the show by posting on psychology-related blogs, and they usually have a place to leave a web address, and I realized during the middle of the night that I would probably get more traction by leaving the psychologypodcast.com address because it's so self-explanatory and also seemingly maybe less self-serving. I just got my black t-shirt with a new logo from the Cafe Press store. I was a bit disappointed in it, though, because the blue square of the new logo doesn't show up very well against the black. Now, it may have been a production mistake, so I've asked them to send me another one. I'm hoping it turns out better. I had a black t-shirt with the old Warhol Freud logo, and the blue in it showed up just fine, so I'm hoping there was maybe just an error in the printing of this new one. However, it may turn out that the shade of blue is just wrong for black t-shirts, so you might be better off getting a different color if you decide to get a t-shirt. As I've said before, I make no money on the sales, but I'd love to think there are a bunch of people out there wearing them. Let me know if you get one. You'll find a link to cafepress.com/shrinkwrapradio on our website. And speaking of our website, it's been totally redone. The colors are different to better match our new logo. Also, you now have the ability to scroll through all the titles, all 126 or 27 at this point, on a single, very long page. I don't know about you, but sometimes I need to do that. Jerry Trumbull and I had a good time chatting with Shrink Wrap Radio fan and artificial life maven Tom Barbalay this past Sunday. And Jerry and I will be doing another Shrink Wrap Radio Live this coming Sunday, December 23rd at 10 a.m. Pacific Time. And we're hoping you'll join us there at www.blogtalkradio/shrinkwrapradio. The call-in number is 646-595-4286. It's a great opportunity for you to call in with your questions and comments. It's been a while since we've had any new additions to our Frapper map. If you're not on there, please add yourself. There's a link to do so on our website. And finally, I'm proud to be part of the Podshow lineup of podcasts. You can check them out at www.podshow.com.
This is Sarah Zeldman from SolutionsForBusyMoms.com. Since every mom has to be an amateur psychologist, I think Shrink Wrap Radio is a great solution for busy moms.
Sarah, thank you very much for that endorsement. We're here for busy moms and busy dads and busy sons and daughters of busy moms and dads everywhere. So what's in our email today? Well, first we hear, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Love the t-shirt designs, by the way." That's great to hear. Does that mean you're buying one? The writer, who's Penny, goes on to say, "I don't send comments, but I continue to enjoy the shows, and I really enjoyed the continuing conversation, the live call-in shows with Jerry." Hey, that's great feedback. That's very important to us because it's kind of new for us, and we're hoping that we're not just talking to ourselves here. She goes on to say, "I've been meaning to send you a guest suggestion, and after hearing you mention going postal during the recent show with Lawrence Miller, it motivated me to send the suggestion in. His name is Dan Corum, and my school recently sent me to take a workshop training with him on identification and prevention of violent actors on campus and in the workplace. He has a website at www.corumassociates.com, two books on the subject, The Art of Profiling and The Rage of the Random Actor. He has researched the demographics and behavior traits of those who commit mass killings on campus or in the workplace and developed a method of identifying them, their potential targets, as well as a method of de-escalating them to prevent violence. While his method of profiling is very similar to others, for example, using the Myers-Briggs and so on, he allows you to quickly identify those random actors. I think you'd enjoy the interview as he is personable and very knowledgeable about his topic. Take care, and I love all the new adventures you're exploring. Penny." Hey, Penny, thanks for that feedback, and thanks for that guest suggestion. It does sound like he might make for a very interesting guest indeed. So I'll put him on my growing guests to invite list. Next, we hear from Tim in Australia, who just writes a very brief one this time. He says, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I love the new website. I really like the whole frame load. I really like the way the whole frame loads, so you can scroll down to the bottom and select older posts immediately. Change is great. Cheers, Tim. Tim, thanks for that feedback on the new site. I'd love to hear from others about it, since I've only just done it, and I did it at some expense, so I'm hoping that, in fact, it's a home run. Next, we get an email from a woman who signs herself as Mercury in Wyoming, and she writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, hello from your lone listener in freezing cold Wyoming. I posted a comment on iTunes about a week ago, but couldn't cut and paste it here, so I guess you'll have to take my word for it." Well, I do take your word for it, but I also went on iTunes and I read it, and I thank you very much for it. And she says, "If you have any books left, I would love one." Well, I put one in the mail for you this very day. She says, "My internet name is Mercury, and that is the name I used on iTunes. I want you to know that I love listening to your show, and it's definitely a highlight of my every week. The range of guests you have is wonderful, and I've learned and been challenged in my beliefs and opinions a lot since I found you almost a year ago." That's my goal, actually. She goes on to say, "I also have been enjoying the live shows. However, I can't participate in them because of church obligations. It's very interesting to hear your discussions with such a variety of people. I have encouraged my friends who are as intrigued by the brain as I am to come by and check your podcast out, and I'm looking forward to hearing what they think of it. Again, thanks for this important podcast, Mercury." I'm glad you think it's important, Mercury. I do too. And maybe it'll help your friends to remember, if you use that tip that I gave earlier in the show, just send them to psychologypodcast.com. Next, we hear, "Dr. Dave, sorry to bother you again." Well, hey, you're not bothering me again. I'm not bothered at all when I get these emails. It is from Mark, who had previously written to share a synchronicity, and so he is, quotes, "bothering me again" with another report. He says, "Two more instances happened today, which are just flat out odd. Last night, I had stayed up until 2 a.m. playing on my computer. Upon going to bed, I set my alarm randomly a few hours past my normal weekday waking time of 5:30. This morning, I launched out of bed at precisely at 8:19, looked out the window to see the weather from the storm last night, and my alarm goes off at 8:20. Yes, a funny coincidence. So I'm presuming you set the alarm ahead without looking at it. And so, and then it just happened. You got up at 8:19 and you had unconsciously set it for 8:20. That's good. That's a good one. He says, "Now the story takes another turn. Yesterday on my way home from work, I was reminiscing an interview I heard many months ago about the 1980s death of Rolls Gracie, a famous jiu-jitsu fighter. I was visualizing what I would do in that situation had I had known him personally. This morning, after waking up precisely 1 minute before my alarm clock goes off, I read this RSS feed, 'Ryan Gracie, the jiu-jitsu superstar, brother to Rolls Gracie, died last night.' Just plain weird." Signed, Mark. And Mark, to add to the weirdness, as I wrote to Mark when I responded, I'm about to get a second granddaughter sometime soon, and there's been a lot of discussion about the names, and my daughter is most likely going to name this granddaughter Gracie, Grace, but the nickname is certain to be Gracie. And there's been a lot of discussion about it because neither my wife nor myself like that name among the various names that we're considering. With apologies to any Gracies that might be in our audience here. So in the midst of all of that, I hear from you talking about a Gracie, so maybe that's synchronicity upon synchronicity. And then we hear from an old friend in Ireland, a longtime listener who I got to meet when I was doing a workshop a couple years ago in Ireland, Paul, who writes, "Hi, David. Hope this finds you well. Was just listening to two episodes there while catching up with some paperwork in the office. The show on leadership and your discussion on artificial intelligence, both excellent. I really enjoyed the new format with Jerry Trumbull. I think it adds a lot of depth to the show, although I still enjoy the old format too. I was just checking out your new design on the website and I'm delighted to see you kept the Irish flag flying there. Best wishes for the holiday season to you and all your listeners. I will send a lengthier message when I have time over the holidays. Best regards, Paul. And I guess I did kind of unconsciously end up with the colors of the Irish flag there. And we know there are no errors in the unconscious, and no one knows that better than Paul, who's studying psychoanalysis. And then we hear Dr. Dave, I'm very much enjoying Shrink Wrap Radio Live and was delighted to be in the Peanut Gallery for show number 3. The exchange between you, Tom, Jerry, and Anna the Man was stimulating, if not downright mind-blowing. Good. There's a very marketable synergy commingled with the warm comfort of an old friendship which comes through in the live shows, and I really hope you and Jerry will continue to do them. I look forward to tuning in again this Sunday at 1 p.m. here on the Eastern Seaboard. We both mentioned having dreams which cause us to wake up and laugh, so I'll share one I had this morning. I should preface it by saying that recently I heard Francis Moore LaPay, Diet for a Small Planet, on our local NPR affiliate. She discussed, among other things, agricultural sustainability. So in the dream, I was in a large crowd of people listening to a speaker promote beans as a sustainably harvested food when a teenage boy piped up, "But haven't you heard about human wind turbines?" I immediately woke up and grinned at my inner child's emergence and adolescent sense of humor. She closes with a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you, your family, and Jerry Trumbull, Sue's Anonymous. Thank you very much for that, Sue's Anonymous, and we'll look forward to you in the Peanut Gallery this coming Sunday, and I loved that dream. And I'm picturing people with little wind turbines strapped to their rear ends and us giving up all dependence upon fossil fuels as a result. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where the name is Shrink Pod, and you're encouraged to leave messages on MyChingo and find the logo and the link for MyChingo on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. And then you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks again to the very non-authoritarian Dr. Robert Altemeyer. Our very next episode will be one of our live call-in shows, as I mentioned previously. The one following that will feature an interview with Dr. Julie Diamond, who will be talking about process work, an approach developed by the Jungian analyst Dr. Arnie Mendel. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.